Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. Okay, I'd like to call this meeting to order, please. I want to thank everyone for being here, and I especially want to thank Shakil Sayed, who's our guest today, who will be introduced by Tony in a moment. Before we do that, I want to remind people of what's coming up. Next month, on May 20th at 7 o'clock, we have o Omer Negev. He's an Israeli. He comes from one of the kibbutzes just outside of Gaza that was devastated on October 7th. And he and so many liberal Israelis who stood for peace has sort of have collapsed under the October 7th, but he's maintained his principles of nonviolence and peace. And so we're going to hear from him how he's balancing grief and principle. The following month, on June 17th, we have If Not Now. Exactly who it will be from If Not Now isn't clear, but If Not Now is one of the very active Jewish young groups that are doing the big protests nationally and here in LA. The following month, we have Yossi Ken, who's going to be is really a placeholder. There are two other people I'm sort of negotiating with. But Yossi will talk about the Abraham Initiative. Now, the Abraham Initiative is not the Abraham Accords, which Trump set up. The Abraham Initiative is an Arab Jewish organization within Israel that fights for Jewish Arab equality. So with that, I will go back to this, and I will stop my share, and I will turn the floor over to Tony, who will introduce Shakil.
I first met Shakil Sayed in the offices of the American Friends Service Committee. That was back in 2007, and I was invited to serve on a committee by Bryce Harris and his wife Carolyn. Sadly, Bryce passed away last July. He was 91 years old, I think. I'd gotten to know Bryce and Carolyn on the 2-week journey of Friends of Sabeel and other groups. Who met with refugees from the Iraq War who had fled to Syria and Jordan. The American Friends Service Committee sponsored a special committee for learning about the Middle East and Islam, which was offered to teachers in the Los Angeles School District. And from the start, I have to say, Shakil was a guiding light for all of us, especially for me. I'd been a proponent of nonviolence and against war and injustice for many years, when I was an academic, and then later on when I got into the insurance business. And because of my background in Victorian and early 20th century literature, I knew generally about things like the Balfour Declaration, the Zionist movement, World War I, the Versailles Conference, the British Mandate. And because Edward Said, the famous Palestinian advocate, had been a scholar of Joseph Conrad, I also knew about and had read a few of his essays and reviews about Palestine. And Shakil taught me about Islam. And he taught me by his presentations in those educational committees and by his exemplary life. Our committee was a rousing but controversial success, I would have to say, among teachers in the LA school district. And thanks to the leadership of people like Wafa Shami and Rula Karam, Vicky Tamush, Linda Tubach, Karen Pally, Bryce and Carolyn Harris, Jeff Cooper, and Shakil, the workshops continued over the next 10 years and educated me even further about the Middle East and its culture and politics, and about the essential beliefs of Islam and the dominant problem of Israel's colonization of Palestine, and the continuing injustice and the brutal treatment of the Palestinian people. And through this transformative project and commitment, Shakil and I, along with Jeff Cooper, became very close friends and partners in peacemaking and pursuit of justice and historical education. So I take real pleasure in being asked to do the honor of introducing Shakil. He's an outstanding leader in Southern California's Muslim and progressive communities. And for more than 2 decades, he's organized minority communities and protecting civil rights, civil liberties, fostering interfaith solidarity, advocating for the rights of immigrants and low-wage workers, and political empowerment of minority communities. He's presently executive director of the South Asian Network, a nonprofit which is, quote, geared towards serving, uplifting, and educating Southern California's South Asian community, the services of which are free of cost, I might add, and sum up, I think, the kind of commitments that Shaquille has made. For more than two decades, he's organized minority communities, protected their civil rights and civil liberties, fostered interfaith solidarity. I can certainly attest to that from many of the dinners that I went to that I had been invited to by him. Advocated for the rights of immigrant and low-wage workers and political empowerment of minority communities. He's an active board member of the American Muslims for Palestine. Previously, he was executive director of the Islamic Shura Council of Southern California, executive director of Orange County Communities Organized for Responsible Development, otherwise known as ACORD. He served on the boards of a range of progressive organizations, including the American Civil Liberties Union, the American Friends Service Community, Clergy and Laity United for Economic Justice, and the Death Penalty Focus. He continues to serve as a volunteer chaplain in prisons. Israel's genocidal war on Gaza, and I'm reading what Jeff Warner had to say. Israel's genocidal war on Gaza, fully supported militarily and diplomatically by the U.S., has reactivated the local Muslim and Palestinian communities in Los Angeles and Orange counties as never before. Since Israel's over-the-top military retaliation to Hamas's October 7th attack, these communities have been out on the street demanding that Israel stop slaughtering their friends and relations in Gaza and the West Bank. And so, as Jeff Warner has written, Shaquille is uniquely situated to understand the outrage in the Muslim and Palestinian communities and how that rage drives ongoing protests in public spaces and legislative advocacy demanding a ceasefire. He will share the community's aspirational goals, who they are directing political pressure at, and how they're partnering with other groups that also oppose Israel's genocidal war on Gaza. Shaquille, take it away.
Thank you, Tony. Very generous.
Let me interrupt for 1 second and ask people who are not muted to please mute yourself until we get to the Q&A. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you, Tony, for very kind and very generous introduction. And I, too, have been blessed with your friendship and your solidarity and learned a great deal from you. And continue to do so. These are the friendships, I think, that we have nurtured over the course of last two decades in Southern California. That is one of the most awe-inspiring aspect of my life. While I lost some friends for speaking truth to power, so to speak, but at the same time, I gained so many of you. So I'm deeply, deeply grateful for your friendship and solidarity. And thank you, Jeff, also for inviting me and for the work that you do at LA Jews for Peace for decades. I mean, that's far back as I know. I remember Jeff came to my apartment in Culver City as he was heading out to Gaza. I don't remember the year, but it has been long, long while ago. You know, you all have inspired me in so many myriad ways with your actual work, unlike many others who talk about it, but not necessarily act on it. So so today I'll share some of the organizing efforts by the Muslim and the Arab community that I know of, and I'm sure I don't know of everything, but to the extent that I do, and it's likely that many of you already know this, but I'll highlight some aspects And then we'd love to have a conversation. So in the Los Angeles area, at the community level, you have Al-Awda, American Muslims for Palestine, local chapter, Palestinian Youth Movement, local chapter, and U.S. Campaign for Human Rights chapter, and a whole host of good people who really want to involve and engage in supporting in solidarity with the Palestinian groups. They, for the most part, work independently based on their capacity, based on the time of the year, etc., etc. But when something happens, then they come to get to, you know, come together and try to coordinate and collaborate and work toward whatever the objective may be. And many of those gatherings, many of you have attended also over the course of 2 decades. And in this particular instance, on 7th of October, when this crisis unfolded, I'm blessed to have good relationship, I guess, with both the larger Muslim community and Palestinian community in particular also, although I'm not of Arab descent, I'm not a Palestinian. But because I have been to Palestine a few times, and have been involved in the work, so they are kind and generous enough to call me when something happens. I said, hey, let's get together, what do we do stuff. So on 8th of October, I got a call, or late night. I didn't get to take that call until the following morning when I heard the voicemail. The crisis unfolded. So happens that my house was full of about 60 guests at the time, because the following Saturday on 14th, my son was getting married. And I was completely torn that those who are trying to respond to this crisis calling me, and they're laying their trust in me for planning, for guidance, for organizing and stuff. And I was completely paralyzed. What do I do? I had that conversation with them, and I said, give me some time, let me think through and get back to you. The same evening on October 8th, a knock happens on my door. I now live in Corona. I used to live in Culver City for 21 years and then moved here 3 years ago, or a little more than 3 years ago. I had a knock on the door. I didn't open the door. Some of my guests who were home here, they opened the door. And turns out two gentlemen, white gentlemen, if I may emphasize, well-dressed, knocked the door, and they opened the door and they asked for me. And the gentleman, my cousin who opened the doors, he happens to be from Canada. He said, gosh, I mean, you know, you have some friends who are so richly suited at this hour at 9 o'clock in the night, suited, booted. And my heart started beating a little bit, I must confess. I opened the door, and I leave it to you to imagine who they were. They were from Federal Bureau of Investigation, who wanted to make sure that I'm doing all right, given what happened in Palestine on October, or Gaza, and what happened on October 7th. So those of you who know me for quite some time, I was under very generous surveillance of FBI for human rights activism and work. So the name is there in the files. And obviously, those who wrote my name in the file may have been transferred or gone wherever, and whoever new came in, and they probably shuffled through the files who were the troublemakers and go visit them. And I told them, obviously, in very colorful language to get off my property at that hour. And they reluctantly did. But that's basically how this thing started. And I immediately called some of my close friends who also are equally, if not more active, to watch out that if somebody has visited me, it's likely that they will visit them as well. And make sure that you give them your peace of mind and few colorful words starting with F and ending at K. So that's how the organizing basically started. Now, the immediate and the first thought was that there are a whole bunch of people of Palestinian descent in Southern California whose family members live in Gaza. So what can we do to reach out to them first to extend our moral support, our shoulder to lean on, and support them in any which way possible? And we called each other and started to organize kind of support groups for those whose family members are there. And they were obviously completely devastated and shocked. Some were receiving some reports initially and others were not. A whole lot of the heart goes out to them, basically, that, you know, we need to support them in every which way. And then the thought thereafter was really to organize and go out and hustle and go on the streets and what have you. And I think that immediately started in a very random fashion, that let's go to the federal building, let's go to the Zionist consulate, and then just protest. And that happened. Some, I think the initial ones were like 50 people, 100 people, a couple of hundred people at different times. Different groups were going at different times. That happened. And after my son's wedding on 14th, Monday, I believe, I requested a meeting with colleagues and I said, let's get together and think through what really needs to be done and what can we do, what are the do's and don'ts and who can do what, division of labor, and so on. And then the big rally we organized immediately, I believe it was 21st of October, and coincidentally, Cornel West happened to be in town that weekend for his presidential campaign, and his campaign staff called and said, we'd like to come if you allow us to. So he was very, very transparent about it. And we did invite him, and we held the rally at Pershing, started at Pershing Square and went around the block. I think it was pretty much all day long. And so different estimates, LAPD says 20,000 and LA Times said 10,000, and some of our people said, no, it was 50,000, whatever, but it was a pretty large crowd and very, very charged. The young people were completely enraged. They wanted to do more than chanting and more than walking the streets. And so some of us who have some gray hair or no hair, we made them sit with us and think through that this is a long battle. You can't really win it overnight. And this is, you have to be patient and steadfast and do more. But one thing they demanded in that conversation, this was the first strategy conversation, let's say, after the 21st rally. And I believe they learned this thanks to our brothers, Black brothers, during the Black Lives Matter movement, where the phrase was coined, this is not your grandfather's movement. And unequivocally, I think every one of them said that we are going to lead this movement now. We want you, the gray-haired people, to support us, to be behind us, but we will lead it. And frankly, to me, that was music to my ears when young people step up and say, we are going to take charge. You know, their energy, their enthusiasm, their commitment, their zeal, their anger, all of their capacity to mobilize, particularly through social media platforms, that I have no clue how to do that. All of those beautiful assets that they bring to the table were beautiful. And we said, absolutely, you should lead, and we will support you. And in this particular instance, I guess I would say 80% of the youth who now I know, I did not know before October 7th, who are now pretty much 24/7 involved in organizing. So an entirely new cohort was born on October 7th in organizing. They didn't know, you know, how to organize, and they didn't quite know where to go, what to do, but they were there, phone call away. They started organizing at the regional level, if I may, you know, more like LA. And then there was another group that formed to organize in Orange County, and then a whole bunch in the respective locales, from Inland Empire to Orange County to South Orange County to LA and North LA and San Fernando Valley, Simi Valley, San Diego, and other smaller enclaves, that you do whatever you can do in your respective city rather than waiting for the big rally to happen. So this is the first time I believe that, you know, street corners and smaller cities and enclaves were fully engaged and involved in this. The second big thing they also demanded, which also is very admirable, really, is they said that not only that we want to lead this movement, but we also don't want to give the platform to anybody from within the Muslim community, from within the Arab community, from and from within the allies and those who are in solidarity with us. Anyone who is not 100% anti-Zionist. So within the Muslim community, just as there are Christian Zionists, there are Muslim Zionists also. And they are respectable people in the community. They, you know, give sermons. They are leaders in clergy or lay leaders in the community. And they believe in whatever they believe. And they have had relationship with and worked with and spoke at events and conferences organized by AJC, ADL, and then quote unquote the Muslim Leadership Initiative, that was a recruiting ground for Muslim leadership to normalize occupation. So this was the second demand, that we do not want any normalizer or normalizing group to share this platform. And hence, no one was allowed, although at the rally, obviously, when 20, 30, 50,000 people are gathered, anybody who wants to be in the limelight wants to take the podium and talk about it. And some were unhappy with it, and some were politely dismissive of, but that did happen. Now the organizing, those started in Los Angeles, similar to Chicago, to New York, to Miami and Dallas, and so on and so forth. AMP played its modest role in saying that how about we form a national coalition task force where one or two or three reps from each region talk to each other on a regular basis and share information, share data, best practices, and plan events and activism accordingly. And that also, I think, produced a lot of good results. The second group, those who either did not want to go on the streets and protest and put themselves, their bodies in danger, so to speak, or at risk, preferred to do delegation visits. You know, the elected folks locally initially started from the federal level to congressional offices, and then later it kind of came down to county to city in respective areas. So so that's, I believe, you know, for the first month or two has been happening. Campus, oh yeah, when I forgot also, for SJP and MSAs, Muslim Student Association, and other solidarity Black and Latinx groups, they started organizing at campus level, both in LA and Orange County and Inland Empire. And some of you now, we know the story, what happened in Pomona College. You know, and as early as today, I think USC decided to not give the space to, for one of the ladies, young ladies, to speak as a valedictorian. Her only crime is that she wears hijab and she has spoken up in defense of Palestinian human rights in the past. And USC, basically after she was announced as a valedictorian to be speaking at the event, is pulled out. That happened like a few hours ago. I just received a text from USC. So a lot of organizing at the school level, at the schools of higher learning as well. And then the movement for the uncommitted started, thanks to Michigan. And that created a new dialogue within the community: which one of the evil is worse? Lesser evil, lesser of the two evil conversation started. And that continues to happen until now. And I'll talk a little bit more about it later. As the organizing was happening, the anti-Muslim, anti-Palestinian incidences were happening in all public spaces and squares, including in schools of higher learning. CARE, as a premier Muslim organization of civil rights and civil liberties, started recording reports from all over. And I think they have all sorts of data available that the intensity is has been more than what happened after 9/11. So thousands and thousands of reports of all kinds. And you all know some of them were fatal. So the first fatality was this young boy of 6 years old in Chicago. And then what happened in Maine, where two young people died and one became permanently injured simply for wearing the keffiyeh on their neck. Similarly to CARE, other organizations who are also in legal business, one Muslim Legal Fund of America, they also had received extraordinary number of calls of incidents, but they don't deal with single cases. They deal only with high impact cases. So they referred them out to CARE. And then for the student community, Palestine Legal, which is the premier organization who supports students with their First Amendment rights, they also recorded more number of calls in the first 60 days than the entire year prior to that. And they completely were out of capacity. So there was some organizing within the Muslim and the Arab legal community to start doing pro bono work and time to give to PAL Legal and to CARE and similar other organizations. Then on the humanitarian end, you have organizers from within the medical field and the community, Med Global being one of the premier ones, and others who started organizing to take humanitarian medical teams to Gaza. And many of them have gone and come back and then report back. So there was a lot of educational component also to listen to eyewitness accounts by those who were able to go there and come back. And that inspired a whole lot of people at many levels. For the public awareness campaign, I think there was a great deal of organizing and still is. To buy billboards for the first time, I think a lot of money was spent, almost $1 million, to my knowledge, just in Southern California, billboards on the abuse of human rights in Palestine. And same thing happened in San Francisco, in Chicago, in New York, and other places. Conversely, some unknown friends of ours, also so-called friends, had mobile billboards with our faces on four sides of the truck in Washington, D.C. AMP's entire board, including yours truly, was on the 20-foot-wide truck with neon signs with images, Hamas supporters. And I think in Chicago also, but DC was more prominent in that. Now, that I think this has been going on, and then Ramadan was coming in, so that created a little challenge for folks. Ramadan is a month of not only fasting but also family time, community time, and gathering time, and so on. It became very, very somber. Prior to that, though, between October and now, one of the most devastating impact of post 9/11 anti-Muslim sentiment at the policy level, what happened was many of the sermons, social justice sermons, human rights sermons that handful few of us used to give, we were in some cases requested, or we were deplatformed by, in other cases, by the mosque leadership to not speak politics from the member, from the pulpit. Talk about morality, talk about ethics, talk about do's and don'ts, blah, 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 but don't talk about politics. That certainly changed October 7th. Mosque leadership was completely devastated, and they needed the speakers to come and speak on this issue. As a consequence, those of us who maybe have been speaking on this issue for a while were invited in different spaces, not only on Friday sermons, but also in community teach-ins during weekends and workday evenings, and many Zoom calls and what have you. But Ramadan was extremely somber for majority of the community across the nation, really. As traditionally has been for quite some time, mosques and Muslim organizations would invite an organized breaking of fast as an expression of interfaith solidarity. And a call was put out by AMP and a few others as well, that particularly in Washington, D.C., White House organizes this ritual. There was a call put out that no one should go. And as it is, it was very controversial from its very inception, but now it became even more so. And as a consequence, the regular attendees, most of whom who were attending these iftar dinners in White House over the course of last two decades and more, I would say 95% of them, I don't know whether it was out of their own volition or because they felt the heat from the community, they did not attend the iftar dinner in the White House. And I think that got the attention of the administration. You all know the story that, you know, they wanted to go to Michigan, talk to leadership. Leadership said, hell no. And they got a, you know, black face there. The famous incident, I think it gave a lot of energy also, the doctor from Chicago who did go, who did accept the invitation. I think there were a group of only 8 people from the community, and Biden, Harris, Sullivan, and Lloyd Austin, I think. Those are the few people, 4 or 5 people from the administration who were there. This doctor had the moral integrity and courage to go there. He said his piece and he left. He walked out on the president. And I think that emboldened many, many people and made people feel proud that someone was finally able to do this, as opposed to either going and enjoying a feast or simply not going. So he decided to. So it was a good strategic move to go there and say his piece and say, you know, screw you. And then he walked out on him. Some of the progressive organizations, philanthropic foundations at the local level and also at the national level. At the national level, I think Ford and Open Society being 2, and at the local level, Weingart being 1 major one, I would say, endowment to some extent. They reached out of the blue to many of us in asking, how can we support you in your organizing capacities? That was a big discussion, to take their money, to not take their money. I think the overwhelming consensus was to not. So at the local level, no one took their money. At the national level, I don't know. Some may have. AMP did not. AMP was offered, and we did not. Because we just didn't know, never it had happened before that anyone, you know, coming out with a blank check, that what impact it may have down the road, and did not. But the intersectional solidarity with social justice and human rights organizations, with whom we already have had, that got more deepened and strengthened. And many new relationships were born. JVP in particular, if not now in particular, I think had inspired and changed perception of quote-unquote Jewish human rights activists within the Muslim and the Arab community in a very significant way. Because clearly they had put their bodies online in spaces and places where Muslims and Arabs are typically not even allowed to go. So for example, taking over Senate building, taking over a House committee meeting, and putting together a kibbutz in front of Blinken's house. These are not the spaces which Muslim and Arab community typically would go. And if they go, they will be beaten up basically, right? So I think, Court Pink had played a pretty important role in organizing in the DC, Virginia, Maryland area. ANSWER Coalition has played a very important role in supporting and organizing in that area. And JVP, much love to them throughout the country in major chapters. I think more young Jews were arrested and committed civil disobedience than any other faith community that I know of. So that, I think, changed the dynamic in terms of relationship, in terms of solidarity, in terms of building relationships and working together. And lastly, I would say things that we already know, I guess, in the entertainment world, a handful few people who are of Arab descent, such as Rami Yusuf, who opened his Saturday Night Live show with a tribute to people in Gaza. And similarly, the other Egyptian American actor, or I don't know whether he's American, but he definitely is Egyptian, Khaled Abdullah, who played Prince Charles in one of those dramas. I didn't know about the guy. And when he did, I asked my children, actually, who is this dude? So I think some of that in the entertainment world had also lifted up this issue in the communities. Now, in conclusion, the short-term goal obviously is to call for a ceasefire. Now, ceasefire became a qualifying thing, interim ceasefire, enduring ceasefire, permanent ceasefire, and blah blah blah. So that's one conversation that happens. In the younger community where I started my conversation with, they are no longer worrying about the ceasefire. They are now completely focused on ending the occupation period. Until that happens, this has no meaning to it. Basically, you feed them and then you bomb them again after 2 weeks. So what's the use of ceasefire? And certainly, there is merit to that conversation also. Any life saved any day is absolutely worth pursuing. But then there is also the other rationale that who are we saving and what for? If eventually they are going to live as occupied people. And lastly, and very lastly, my second daughter, who some of you have met and spoken with, who used to work at work for Amazon Studios for the last 5 years, accidentally laid off because of her activism for Palestine over the course of the last 4 years, along with a group of young Jews and some Hindus from India. They had a Palestine solidarity affinity group within Amazon. And some of you may have seen her writings and on a couple of op-eds and interviews on a couple of news channels and stuff. Although that happened a little less than a year ago, but I, for one, firmly believe that that accidental layoff is not accidental. so that kind of, I think, impact has happened on many, many people in the academia, in corporate world, in other even nonprofit world. South Asia Network that I work for, we issued a statement in solidarity with the people in Gaza. My board received 18 emails to see me fired, and a few top donors decided to cut their funding to the small agency that I work for. So those type of personal impact has happened to many people across the country, all kinds of stuff. But so the organizing continues, and the Muslims and the Arabs and the Palestinian are deeply troubled and in pain, in anguish, in sorrow, but also emboldened to not let go. And continue the organizing and activism to push for ending the occupation and ending and bringing this current crisis to some kind of end, so more some lives are saved, those that lives are already there. I'll pause there. I think I have taken 45 minutes of your time. We'll be happy to answer any questions and clarifications.
Tony, did you want to do the Q&A, or do you want me to do it?
Oh, no, you can do it.
You got your hand up, so why don't you do the first question?
Okay. Yeah, I noticed that there's reluctance. I read today an article about how George Clooney's wife, who has the Clooney Foundation, right, and she's Lebanese and Palestinian, but she has refused to make any kind of specific alignment with the resistance against it. Clooney has done a kind of obscurantist response about how terrible everything is, but you know, they've got close political friends all the way through, so I suspect there's a good bit of that going on. What impresses me most, Shaquille, is that there were still small groups in Israel itself, like B'Tselem and 972 Mag,
sure,
which have done extraordinary work in releasing, you know, well-founded journalistic things about what really happened on October 7th,
yes,
and
8th, yes,
and 9th. And the latest 972 about this automated artificial Lavender intelligence thing, yeah, is just extraordinary. I keep waiting for them to be shut down the way Al Jazeera was shut down.
Yeah.
But they've been able to hold their own, and I think that's because you've also got Haaretz doing journalism like that too. A lot of really, really solid people would have to be shut down, but wouldn't surprise me if it continued. It's a long struggle, as you old guys said to the young ones right at the beginning. Have patience. It's a long struggle, but it's right. Nice to see their impatience. So that's all.
Yeah. Yeah. No, thank you. Thank you for bringing up in. Certainly, I think, you know, the amount of human rights work that's happening in within Israel, it's very inspiring and so important. And the Lavender Project that you read, and it boggles your mind. I mean, how anyone with an ounce of humanity can engage in this type of warfare. But I guess, you know, this is going to be the future.
If there's no one else, I will ask a question. Samir has his hand up, so I've got my hand up, but let me do other people first because I'm the moderator, so I'll go to Samir. Sure.
Oh, you want me to start?
Yeah, go, Samir.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, hi, Shaquille. Thank you. That was very nice lecture or talk. Anyway, I wanted to ask you, for the last 2 days, this weekend, any reaction to from the community, and anybody called you, or after Iran send 350 missiles,
right,
into Israel, any reaction from the community?
Yeah, I mean, I think the conversation is, you know, good theater and nothing more. Clearly it was not to hurt anyone, nor anyone was hurt. no one knows what's the purpose. I mean, we all have our own theories, right? Political theories, who did what and why. It was very nice of them to give a week notice and say, we are coming after you in a week. Prepare yourself, right? So there are lots of theories. I you know, people are scratching their head as to what happened. But I think the most common theory is that this is politically helpful, Netanyahu, politically helpful for Biden, mm-hmm. both. Him to save his skin there and him to save his office here. But then people say that, you know, Iran is smart enough not to engage in this time because they will be annihilated completely. But and then the theory there is that, you know, they deliberately this kind of light action or lighter action to see or to learn defense architecture that other side has. This is the only way to shoot some, you know, small firecrackers and see what happens, how do they defend themselves, and that will give them deeper knowledge of the other side. And then when a real situation happens, then they would know how to penetrate. Who knows? So all sorts of theories, but, you know, I continue to ask myself this question, you know, I mean, what happened here?
You remember what Trump said about 2021 when the Iranians coordinated the strike against the U.S. and doesn't that remind you of this time is the same thing, that it was coordinated with President Biden, with the American administration?
I mean, could be.
Yeah.
We don't know at this point. At some point we would come to know. But I think the overarching scenario is definitely widening the war in the region is helpful for everyone. All right. Politically speaking. But then the counter argument to that is, if that happens, even in some small way, oil prices are going to shoot up like up the roof, and Biden is bound to lose the election then, right? So there are too many, I think, angles and aspects to think about. And I don't believe there is any one answer or one angle. Clearly, Iran did to appease their citizenry that, you know, we will not take this lightly because our sovereignty was threatened. But then Syria didn't do anything. It was, after all, in Syrian airspace, right? But it also, right, it also exposed the extent of hypocrisy of our country here, right? So our ally goes to one state and shoots down the people of another state. And then we stand up and say, we will support you with an ironclad support for your defense. Now suddenly the aggressor became a victim. And I think this continues to be the case, right? A perpetual victimhood. And if you call that victimhood out, then you're anti-Semite.
Who knows? I think also that this Iran hit against Israel, that, I mean, it came to help Netanyahu in a way and help the United States to get out of Gaza in a way. I mean, they have to end it.
Yeah, I'm going to, as the moderator. I want to bring this back to Gaza. And in fact, in my view, which I guess I shouldn't say as the moderator. In my view, the worst thing about that attack was that it was a distraction from the main problem, which is the genocide in Gaza and trying to stop the genocide in Gaza and make a better life for those people. Tony, did you have your hand up?
I did, Jeff, but I took it down. I decided it was not relevant because I do want to focus on Gaza myself. If there's anything that perturbs me, it's this. How shall I say it? This adamant failure of the United States to tell Israel, open the goddamn gates, let the trucks in, and start feeding all the people, and don't kill them just because you think that Hamas is going to steal some of the food. I mean, you know, I hope someone is arguing somewhere along the line, you know, maybe that food is going to go to feed some of the hostages. And I can't imagine that the health of the hostages is very, very good right now. But I suspect the real question I was going to ask is, what do you think is going on in the negotiations? I suspect that the reason they're not going through is mainly because what Hamas is asking Israel to do is release the hostages that they have taken since right. October the 7th.
Right.
Plus, people who have been sentenced to life sentences in prison, or people who are in jail and have been there under administrative detention with no real charges. And Israel is so reluctant to do that.
Correct. Yeah. So I don't know where these negotiations are going to go. Certainly, Hamas as the negotiating group has hardened its position also, that, you know, we have lost already 35,000 lives and another 50,000 under the rubble somewhere, and, you know, 1.5 million completely displaced. Ismail Haniya lost his 3 sons or grandchildren, right? So that kind of hardens you that what else do I have to lose anyway? What's interesting, however, though, I mean, Hamas is one as a resistance group, but anti-Hamas resistance or anti-Hamas sentiment in Gaza, even today after what has happened, does not exist. And this is something that I think I hope and pray that the policymakers in our country begins to see. If the ultimate objective was to, quote unquote, eliminate Hamas, not even an iota of that has been accomplished today. If anything, Hamas is way, way, way stronger today, not physically, but intellectually and spiritually, has inspired people within occupied in West Bank, 470 or 80, whatever number, and I, pardon me for not giving the right number, has been killed post October 7. That's not reported only because the focus is on Gaza. I think 2,500 or some arrested, etc., etc. So Hamas has become an inspiration now within the Palestinian community and outside the Palestinian community. And I think our country has miserably failed, and Netanyahu and company has miscalculated and continues to miscalculate that we are going to go into Rafah and eliminate Hamas. No, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. Which then means that ultimately you have to negotiate with them. And they already claim in some press reports that we already have claimed the victory, that we became the primary negotiator for this now. there are no interlocutors now. They are directly negotiating with us. That means we are an entity that you need to reckon with, right? So at different levels, if you look at the political level, if you look at the military level, if you look at the resistance level, if you look at the popular level, nothing that was intended, quote unquote, to happen in Gaza has not happened. Hamas is there, and so on. So it is mind-boggling and completely irrational, you know, for Netanyahu's government to really be pursuing this. And one would also argue that you are potentially risking the lives of Jewish Israeli citizens in Israel in the bigger scheme of things and in long run. yeah, I mean, it's very, very confusing and illogical and irrational for Netanyahu to be doing this, unless if those who say that he's trying to save his skin, you know, I mean, even that doesn't make sense to me. That how can one human being, unless they are completely narcissistic and have no remorse for any human life, including your own, to engage in such an approach where my life is it, nothing matters more. I'm loss of words to really articulate this, how one's mind works in this space.
Actually, you can understand it more when you apply more racism to the Israelis.
Sure.
And that helps you understand that. But what I want to ask is, you said that the young people who are running these protests or are sort of in charge, they are focused beyond a ceasefire. They're focusing on ending the occupation. And when I go to protests downtown and march with various Palestinian or Muslim groups, right, the most common sign I see is Free Palestine.
Yeah.
Can you talk about what's behind the sign Free Palestine? And when they talk about ending the occupation, what is that? What vision are they sort of developing for beyond the occupation?
Yeah, so I mean, the message behind Free Palestine is ending the occupation, really. And now, what's the vision post occupation? If you ask me, I don't know. So I mean, you know, just as you, I went to Palestine multiple times, and some people say I can completely live next to an Israeli Jew in peace. I have no problem. Just give me my dignity back. And then there are other people who said I can never live next to a Jew, period. I think age has to do, generation has to do with this. There's a generational factor, most definitely. And the same is true in Israel also, right? I mean, I went to Tel Aviv, I went to Haifa, I went to Nazareth, met with people and found the same sentiment, not on my dead body. In Hebron, I mean, I was thrown out of this place. I went with the IFPB at the time in the settler community, where the dude who was born in Philadelphia, who is the head of their security team in Hebron, in one of the settler community. So I asked him, I said, you know, would you like to have a debate with me, to just have a conversation? And so that we can live together. So now he thought maybe that I'm either of a Palestinian or Arab descent. He said, not on my dead body. So you have that also. But for the most part, Jeff, answer your question, I think within the Palestinian community, people have given up. they don't know either whether one state, two state, federation, blah, blah, blah. And I, as a non-Palestinian, I never have had the courage really to engage with them in that conversation. Only because it's their thing that however they feel proper that they need to structure that. But there is a sense of the Hamas's idea of that Israel is illegitimate state and cannot exist and must not exist. That view is not popular. That view is not practical. And at least in the occupied Palestine in West Bank, overwhelming majority of the people that I met and I stayed at their homes and ate their food, they really don't care. They really don't care. They just want to live in peace and dignity so that their children and grandchildren can have some, you know, sense of future. Now, the folks here, what they want, I mean, you know, we have the privilege and the pleasure to really sit back, enjoy vanilla ice cream, and then talk about Palestine. I'm talking about Palestinians living in the United States, like my, you know, us non-Palestinians. We have this luxury to have this conversation. A person in Palestine who is in, you know, particularly in West Bank and Gaza, they're talking about life. I may not be alive in the next 2 hours. I may not be alive in the next 15 minutes. I just don't have the luxury and the wherewithal and the capacity to think what Palestine should look like in, you know, after the occupation. I just don't. It is so such a different dynamic, you know. I used to think myself also, frankly, you know, in my first or the second visit, I used to ask this question. Then I realized, you know, I have a friend, Iyad Barnat. Some of you may have visited him also in the village of Bilain, whose village was cut off by this apartheid wall. I stayed at his house. For the first time, I stayed in his house. We slept on the terrace, open terrace. And when he was sleeping, some of his friends were sitting by the wall to make sure that there's no raid in the night. And he's sleeping with shoes on. And a torchlight next to him and a cigarette packet. And I wonder why he's wearing shoes in the night. And the following morning, I asked him, he said, I never know when I have to run. And I don't take my shoes off in the night. So that reminded me that, you know, how difficult it is for them to imagine what the following morning is going to look like. Yeah, so it's a completely different dynamic. I know young people here obviously are, you know, romanticizing in some way that, you know, we like to see this. Maybe true. But I really leave that big question to the Palestinian people living under occupation to decide what's best for them that they can.
I can say something. I think that
thank you, Samir, for your comments. And
I wanted to say something.
Yeah, just say something. And I basically agree. And a lot of where the future might be is what is the best path rather than what is out there, what path is available. Anyway, Samir, why don't you take it?
Yeah, that the Palestinians and the Arab community here, I mean, when they see, you saw thousands of them carrying Free Palestine, I think that what they have in mind is one democratic state. That's what they are thinking. From the river to the sea, one democratic state. So when they say Free Palestine, they mean free historic Palestine, one democratic state. So that what they see now and in the future to happen. And regarding to the Palestinians under occupation, I think they gave up on two-state solution. And they are just looking for anything else, but they gave up on two-state solution. From all my contacts, how they are feeling right now, that's what they probably thinking, that two-state solution is out of the question, so we have to find something else.
Shakil, you said that you're implying that the people here and the people in Gaza and maybe in the West Bank have really different goals in mind, that the people there are more grounded in a reality. How much communication is there between the local community and the people on the ground?
I think the communication is there, but communication is there more at a personal level, in a personal capacity, rather than any intellectual or strategic conversation that what ought to be there. But when we went, several times we met with these NGOs at in occupied West Bank, including with Beth Salem in Israel. Now they have views. I mean, as Samir says, that most of the quote unquote intellectual class, if I may use that word, they have no problem living side by side in one democratic state. Yeah, in fact, they prefer that, and I think that's a prevailing opinion, so to speak. But there is no formal survey or polling that has happened on this question of one or two. And hence, it's an open-ended question.
Tony, your hand's up.
Yeah. In the introduction that I read that Jeff had written, there was a comment about what is the political target of the organized Muslim community in the United States? I mean, the one thing that makes me ashamed of being an American more than anything else is that there are at least four laws that we are in constant violation of. The Arms Export Control Act, the Leahy Amendment, a couple of other things, because we know where the ammunition and the planes and the tanks and everything else is going. We know that it's being used for violations of humanitarian law, war crimes, genocidal acts. And the one thing that just disturbs me is that AIPAC has such tight control over Congress and the Senate that there is just no room to breathe. And yet we're violating these laws all the time. I wish that private citizens could bring a case in the ICJ against their own country, but you can't do it.
Yeah, I mean, laws are one, but I think, even a bigger thing, Tony, as we all agree on, is that we are active, we are an active accomplice in committing this genocide. We were an active accomplice in committing another genocide in Iraq in 2003, where 1 million people were butchered, right? What was that phrase of Madeleine Albright, the dead lady now, was the price worth it? And she said, oh yeah, the price is totally worth it, right? So when you're coming with that mindset, really, a law here, a law there, a policy here, a policy there, who cares? if United States were to decide on not supporting and not giving diplomatic, military, and financial cover to the apartheid state, in less than a week it will stop. Or frankly, if any of the Arab regimes grow some balls and stop oil supply to the entire Western world, You know, there'll be a third world war. Nobody's going to take that lightly, but they have the resource to do it, you say, and they have the power to do so, but they will not. So it's all about power, money,
wrong leaders,
racism.
Yeah, and they did it once before.
Correct.
1978, 79.
Yeah.
1973.
Both, actually.
Yeah, we killed the guy after that, right?
King Faisal.
So they know that there are examples. If we do this, then what happens? But at some point in time, it is my firm belief, and I, you know, as a man of some modest faith, I believe that this apartheid regime shall come to an end, just like the apartheid regime in South Africa came to an end. I only hope and pray it happens before I die. Because at the end of the day, you know, I believe in humanity. You know, some of us wake up late, and you know, most of us were up in the night on October 7th, and some of our own fellow countrymen are still sleeping after 35,000 people killed.
Yeah.
The best solution is one secular democratic state. That's it.
Are there other questions? Judy, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I did the wrong one. I just want to go back to what Tony said a while ago was about the trucks. I mean, this isn't, I can't believe that between United States and United Nations and all the countries in the United Nations that we can't get food to these people. And I keep thinking, well, why doesn't Biden show these starving children? Like, looking at these starving children, I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of them. This is just crazy. And the whole world can't get food in because Israel says no. And they want to go through the trucks and they might find something in there. And then they slowly go through a truck. And then Blinken says today that he's so happy that, oh yeah, we got it. What do you say? We got 100 trucks in or not nearly enough. And we hold all the power and we won't feed these people. I kind of don't get it. And the United Nations says to feed them too. I mean, the whole world's saying feed these people, and Israel says no. That's all.
Yeah, no, it's mind-boggling.
Biden should tell the news people to put more pictures of these starving children on the news. People aren't seeing it. I wasn't really seeing it myself. I saw a couple, but then I saw a lot of it. I mean, it's just insane. There is famine all over the place. And this isn't Africa. I mean, this is a civilized Israel, the civilized country over there in the middle of the supposedly the only civilized country. And these people are starving, famine through the whole country.
Yeah.
Ellie?
Yeah, Shaquille, thank you. Thank you, Shaquille, for your talk, for your knowledge. My question is of a personal vein. How do you, you know, all these years, how have you kept your sanity, if I may ask?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, you know, it's not easy. I must confess that I think I'm not Palestinian, but only because I have been there and I have eyewitnessed the suffering of the people. I think it impacts me more. For the first time in my entire life, I'm 60, turning 64 now this year. For the first time in my life, I was this close to go to actually a mental health therapist and sit and pour out. I believe my faith has, you know, helped me sustain. But this was the first time, frankly, that it couldn't sustain me. So I was trying to find some other way to really support myself, I guess. And so I can only imagine, but then I ask myself, you know, if I'm feeling this way, what right do I have to give up? when the father and the mother and the young child in Gaza is not giving up, in West Bank they are not giving up. So yeah, memories of them. And I remember, you know, my very, very first visit to occupied Palestine in 2008. I went to the quote-unquote Holy Mosque in Aqsa. I prayed, and I had other friends, and I said, you know, just give me 2 hours or 3 hours of time just to ground myself and so on. And I was in the mosque. I prayed and so on. I was just sitting there and kind of quiet, meditating maybe, and so on. And an older gentleman, I don't know, 80-year-old, comes and tapped me on the back and asked me in very broken English, are you visiting? And I said, yes, I am visiting. And we had that conversation. And then he left, said enjoy and so on, and he left. And after 2.5 some odd hours, when I was done, I was leaving, he was waiting for me at the exit, at the main door. He didn't want to disturb me, I guess, at the time. He just wanted to confirm that I'm a visitor. And then he, I know he's waiting for me, but he's pretending that he's not waiting for me. And he said, where are you going? I said, I'm going to my hotel. He said, I want you to come to my house. And so I asked him, where is his house? He said, you know, it's around the corner and just come, let's walk together. And, you know, there's a small enclave, which many of you have been to, Sheikh Jarrah, which became also very popular not too long ago. In that neighborhood, he was there. So I went and obviously before we reached, he had already called his family to set up a feast. So the food and all was laid out and the whole bit. I was treated super royally. We had meal and we talked, and he's like my, you know, father. So I gave him all the respect I could and was really touched deeply by their hospitality. At the end of that conversation, I asked him, I said, you know, look, I'm going to go back to my comfort and luxury in the next week or 10 days. But I do have, you know, a lot of friends in United States. What message should I give them? What should I tell them on your behalf? He smiles and he goes, son, go tell them that we are going to be on this land, and my generation and generation is going to be on this land, so that your generation and generation can come and visit us. I mean, you know, that expression of resistance and steadfastness and commitment and he's 80 years old, keep in mind, or maybe more. You know, that's inner strength, spiritual strength to say, we are going to here, we are not going anywhere, and we will not go here because your children and grandchildren can come here and visit us. Moments like those, you know, when I'm in my downtime, I think of that. I saw another older man, blind, literally blind, and we were walking in a neighborhood in Jerusalem. He was fixing the drainage duct in front of his house. He's laying these bricks so nobody trips in, and he's blind. And I just stopped. And I'm looking at this man, and there were other friends with me. And I asked him, you know, you're unable to see, let somebody else do it. He said, no, this is my house. I want to make sure nobody trips over and gets hurt. A lot of visitors come to Jerusalem to support us. I want to make sure that they are not hurt. I mean, instances like those, you know, give me a sense that what am I to complain here? And I need to do more. So I kind of, you know, try to remind myself of our privilege that we are blessed with.
Yes. There are hundreds of municipalities, unions, institutions across the United States who have passed resolutions in support of the Palestinians. How much of that is being driven from the Muslim and Palestinian communities, and how much are sort of Americans?
Yeah. I don't know if I can put a number to it. In some cases, they have led. In other cases, they have supported. Right. But there is a greater awareness, certainly, you know, civic engagement to go and push for this. And where I think I do know what has happened is in communities where there's a sizable Muslim community, if their city council has not passed a resolution, they have raised hell in those cities. That they have done. But in some areas, they have, you know, led the campaign, and others join in other cases, non-Muslims and non-Arabs have initiated the resolution and then Muslims supported. And even in Southern California, if you look at, right, the city of...
Pasadena.
Well, also Pasadena, but no, much before Pasadena.
Long Beach?
Kudahy, Cudahy, small Latinx, 95% populous town. No Muslims there. That little working class groups, low income, low wage worker group, they passed the first resolution in greater LA area in support of Palestinian human rights. And then, of course, many other cities have.
Okay. Helen, you've got your hand up.
Thank you. Thank you, Shaquille. Very interesting, very inspiring.
I love you. Thank you.
So some of you probably know that a group called Justice for Palestine is working on trying to coax the Santa Monica City Council into passing a resolution.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, the group is trying to induce a city council person to introduce it and put it on the agenda on April 23rd. So what is that? Next Tuesday, correct? Yeah. So we're hoping to get as many people at Santa Monica City Council meeting on April 23rd. I can put the details as to the time of the meeting and the address of the meeting in the chat if anyone is interested in having that information. And there is a way to sign up to speak at the meeting. I'm not great on details about their procedure. There are other people that are paying closer attention, but I believe that even if we don't succeed in getting it on the agenda, there is a time during the meeting allocated to public comment where people can speak to an issue, whether it's on the agenda or not. So that the plan is to, even if we don't get it on the agenda, to use that time to talk about what's going on in Palestine, in Gaza. So I'm going to look for that information right now and put it in the chat.
Okay.
Good. Thank you. Thank you, Helen, for sharing that.
You're welcome.
And I'll see you there, Helen.
Wonderful. Love seeing you, Ellie, all the time.
Jeff, how many signatures have you gotten for that petition?
I myself have gotten 5 pages, and there's about 7 or 8 of us working on it.
Mm-hmm. Hundreds.
Yeah. Hundreds? As in terms of signature, yeah, easily hundreds.
Also, I just need to add to what Helen said, and before I do, I just want to thank you, Shaquille. it was very, very moving, what you said. If you want to speak, you can speak for 2 minutes. You have to sign up ahead of time at the City Hall, which is on Main Street. If they start signups around between 5 and 5:10, and you just go to, there's a little machine there, and you just tap in your name, and you have a choice. Do you speak 1 minute or 2 minutes? You hit 2 minutes. You don't have to say whether you're a resident of Santa Monica or anything. And then they, at 5:30, they open up. This is what they did on the ninth at the last meeting they had. They open it up at 5:30, and depending on where you are in line to speak, you get up and there's a timer in front of you. And at 2 minute, when the 2 minutes are up, it goes beep, beep, beep. So you can speak for 2 minutes, and it doesn't have to be on the agenda, or it can be on the agenda, as Helen said. So I would recommend, if you want to come and have something to say, I would say get there between 4:30 and 5. And there's a sign up on the first floor and the second floor, because the
in Santa Monica, right?
What's that?
In Santa Monica?
Yes, yeah. Santa Monica.
I'm putting the City Hall right now in the chat. It's 1685 Main Street, Santa Monica, in the council chambers.
And the council chambers are on the second floor.
I don't see it in the chat.
I'm about to do it right now here. So I'm talking and writing at the same time.
Okay.
You're muted, Jeff.
If there are no additional questions, I want to thank Shaquille personally. I learned a lot, and you gave us a good feeling for what's going on in the dynamics in the community. And we should all hold the faith. Yeah. And the recording will be online. I'll send the announcement for the recording in about 2 hours.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And bless your hearts. And let's stay strong until Palestine is free.
Shaquille, hi to Sarah and the kids. And
I will. You do the same at home to everyone. Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
And Shaquille, those two stories about the Jerusalemites, the older person and the blind person, one, those two, these two stories. Thank you so much. Those are inspiring. With your permission, I'll keep recycling those.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Very kind of you. Appreciate it.
Good night. Let us know when
thank
you're
you, Shaquille.
I will.
Know when you're coming to town so Jeff and I can have lunch with you or something.
Yeah, definitely. We owe this to ourselves for a long time. Yeah. Thank you so much. All right. Take care. Good night.
Take care. See you, Tony.
Bye, everyone.
Have some celebration soon.